And now on WRS, Michael McKay with the McKay Interview.
Hello, everyone. I'm back on Zoom today, and though it's not my preferred medium for the McKay Interview, it does have its uses. For example, I would have to travel today to Paris in order to meet my special guest face to face, because that is where Real Miller is based, at UNESCO, an acronym most people are familiar with, the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization. But Zoom easily bridges that 560-kilometer distance between Pune in Switzerland, where I live. Though between you and me, I would much prefer a trip to Paris this summer. Real Miller is one of the world's leading authorities on the theory and practice of using the future to change what people see and do. He's recognized as an innovative and globally experienced project initiator, designer, and manager, and is widely published in academic journals and other media on a range of topics from the future of the internet to transforming strategic processes. He's worked as a senior manager in the Ontario Public Service. He's a Canadian and at the OECD in Paris, economics, science and technology, education, territorial development, development center, and the International's Future Program. In 2005, he founded a consultancy called Experidox to advise clients on how to use the future more effectively. And in 2012, he was appointed head of foresight at UNESCO. His newest book is Transforming the Future, Anticipation in the 21st Century. He's truly a very special guest. Real Miller, welcome to the McKay Interview.
Thank you very much. Real pleasure to be here.
Real, I'm fascinated by what you do. And we've spoken before, as you know. But before you answer all my questions, let me start with an obvious one. UNESCO seems to have been around forever. It must be one of the most immediately recognizable acronyms in the world. How long has it been around? Why does it exist? And what does it do? What's it there for?
Well, very, very good question. And it allows me to kind of give a background type answer, which is, you know, at the global level, we're talking about things that are in common for everybody. And actually, discussions were already underway prior to the Second World War about putting together a kind of a council of education, some sort of global body to talk about education. And then obviously, culture is another topic that has global connections and global relevance. But right after the war, just about when things were in 1945, the ministers got together to talk about putting together an organization that would deal with education and culture for the global community. And that's what UNESCO is about. These days, I like to say, and I think it reflects what we know about the world around us as it has evolved, is that UNESCO is really about knowledge. I like to call it UNKNOW, K-N-O-W, the UN Knowledge Organization, where we're concerned with the creation and use of all human knowledge. And that's one of the fascinating aspects of being at UNESCO, is that we're really able to function, as our mandate calls for, as a global laboratory of ideas. And that's the work that we do in a whole wide range of areas related to human knowledge.
Thanks, Rila. Look, I've got lots of specific questions for you, but let me go to another general question. You'll understand why I'm asking you this question, because of the nature of our audience, who are not specialists, but generalists, many of them. You must be tired of being asked this question, but I have to put it to you right at the beginning, because your professional title is so intriguing and must include a multiple of things. What is futures literacy, and why do you at UNESCO believe that it's important?
Well, again, it goes with the territory, and it's a pleasure, in fact, to be able to share what in effect is the fruit of a very long learning voyage on my part, and each of us knows that we've taken serendipitous and all sorts of byways and paths in different directions. Futures literacy is the fruit of a quest, actually, that I started back when I was in Ontario, and I ran a large project called Vision 2000, which was thinking about the future of the community college system. This was back in 1988.
And I'd come off of 1988, you said?
Yes, 1988. Oh, that's
okay.
Right. And I'd come off a period working in the forecasting department at the OECD, where I started my career in 1982. And what was striking about all of that was how do you think about the future? And it was one of those things where, you know, you begin to, first of all, you feel a bit kind of victimized yourself because, well, how am I supposed to know what the future's about? And then you start to talk to other people and you realize, well, of course, they don't know either what the future's about. Furthermore, you know, their imaginations have not actually been that kind of developed by exploring this question, you know, what is the future? How do I think about it? What's the impact of these images of the future in my mind? And basically for the last, you know, 30 plus years, I've been trying to figure out what it means to be more capable. That's where the literacy comes in. You know, learning to read and write is a skill, it's a capability. And it's a nicely universal capability that layers on top of something we're all familiar with. It's what you and I are doing right now. We're talking. And talking is, of course, the foundation, the cornerstone for being able to write and to read. In the same way, it turns out, anticipation, so being able to imagine things in the future, because you can't actually go there, is something that everybody does, from a baby before they can talk to, you know, the somebody trying to lead a nation. All of that's about anticipation. And you can actually get better at it in the same way that you can augment your ability to speak by reading and writing. You can augment your capacity to anticipate by becoming more futures literate. And why is it important? Well, I mean, in a sense, you know, why is it important to be able to read and write? It's because it opens doors. It's a capability. It's something that enhances the human desire, but also to a certain extent, talent to try and understand the world around us. So it's a capability, and capabilities are fundamental. Arguably, reading and writing, so the writing as a tool, is one of the most fundamental breakthroughs for humanity ever. I mean, we knew how to talk, but did we know how to write? No, we didn't. We invented that and we diffused it. In the same way, futures literacy and its relationship to something as primordial as anticipation is something that really has the potential to enlarge the scope, the depth, the diversity of what humans are able to do.
Okay, so let's examine that general point you've made by let me put some specific things to you. For example, I read in some preliminary notes of climate change, racism, and the oppression of women, to name just three, and I'm interested to know more about what effective contribution futures literacy is making to these complex and emotional issues.
Michael, this is a very important and a question that touches, I think, all of us very deeply. And it's certainly the case, and you could see it from the resonance of Extinction Rebellion and the accusation, which I think is merited, that we've created a very dangerous and difficult situation and we have no idea what to do. That doesn't mean we're not trying, but I think there's a fair, you know, recognition as well that it's probably not adequate and also is very uncomfortable. And I guess the key here is to try and understand better the relationship that humans have created between the past, the present, and the future. And I want to kind of make this a very broad-based picture. Not every human community has manifested what I call a monumentalist tendency.
Explain what you mean by monumentalist tendency.
Yeah, I'll get into that. I mean, yeah. You know, the imperial city in China, the large pyramids at Chichen Itza in Mexico, the pyramids obviously in Giza in Egypt, these temples and monuments, the Colosseum, these are ways of relating to the future. Arguably, the greatest legacy of the 20th century and now the 21st, let's say 1,000 years from now, Michael, will be concrete. And probably radioactive waste. What will people 1,000 years from now be dealing with that they'll remember us by? In the same way that we remember the Romans by going to see the Colosseum, you know, they'll be remembering, or the Great Wall of China, we'll be remembered for this unbelievable amount of heavy concrete we've produced. The notion of status, stature, the notice of a legacy as something that, in fact, is imposed, not invited, by future generations. The proposition that it's in their best interest to do what I've done and what we've done, we know works in the past, because that's the best way to be safe and secure. These are all ways of doing something, to use a pejorative term, colonizing the future. It involves an attitude towards tomorrow, which I think lacks generosity. And the reproduction of things that we consider bad. Okay, so here climate change is something we consider bad. Oppression is something we consider bad. The scars of slavery, which still are so manifest today. How is it that despite the fact that we clearly express and know that slavery is unacceptable and that that way of treating people is unacceptable, we nevertheless reproduce many of the oppressive and violent aspects of that past world? This leads to the question, how are we thinking about the future? How are we relating ourselves and our current actions to tomorrow? And how can we break the chain of reproducing things that we do not want to reproduce? And there, futures literacy has a role to play.
But you have to help me on that one, Miyoki. Draw some connections between those things you said, these great monuments of the past, Giza, Karnak in Mexico, and what you're doing in terms of future literacy. And maybe it's linked to the question I have here coming next, which is when I read some of the things that you'd written about, you use an expression called poverty of imagination. I mean, my question, in a way linked to the previous question, is what effect is UNESCO's future literacy program having on the curriculum that is taught to young people in schools around the world, in the sense of preparing that generation, my grandchildren, for example, to the world that they will inherit?
Michael, this is so fundamental, because so many people feel this so urgently. But let me say that even the way we formulate the question, it makes it difficult to understand what I consider to be part of the answer. Okay. And let me put it to you this way. Yeah. When people lived their entire lives thinking that the earth was flat, right? They thought that you could fall off the edge of the earth. The monsters they described, the voyages they imagined, were characterized by this understanding that the world was flat. Okay, when they discovered the world was round, perhaps they didn't believe it, which certainly is what happens often when new ideas come along. But eventually, when they believe that the new idea is credible and they accept it, they still have a great deal of difficulty changing their language, changing their imaginaries, changing the monsters that they think are hiding on the edge of the earth.
Well, it's uncomfortable. It's a human condition to feel uncomfortable if you've been challenged.
Yes, of course. And that goes to the root issue here, Michael, and I think it's I've described this as a pathology. We have set ourselves up by the way we think about the future to be failures and to be frightened. Why? Because instead of integrating uncertainty and ephemerality and novelty as sources of creativity, instead of taking an approach which says, I am confident that I can sense and make sense of something that has no name, because it is not in the dictionary of yesterday, but it's in the dictionary of a year from now or 10 years from now, and I will invent that. Instead of being confident with the creative nature of our universe and taking a positive view of the only certainty we have, which is change, we resist change. We turn change into an enemy. We turn uncertainty into an evil that upends our plans and certainly disrupts and often destroys our ambitions to control tomorrow. So this makes it so difficult. When you say prepare our children, the thing for the, and I think many parents can relate to this. I don't know what challenges my children will face. Will it be a pandemic? Will it be a world war? Will it be whatever? I don't know. What can I do for them? Can I try and control that? Can I try and impose my idea of a preemptive solution? I don't think so. What I can do is make sure that they are capable and that they are able to understand and observe, and they're not frightened by the change. And if they have that confidence and that capability, and here's the key word, Like reading and writing, it's a capability. It opens up the world. It makes us better able to understand. Futures literacy, with something as fundamental to our hopes and fears as the images of the future, people don't really realize it. But our images of the future are absolutely riveting. They direct our attention. They focus us in terms of what we can name, what we can perceive, what we think is important. If we don't have a better understanding of those images and take a more humble relationship, position with respect to the future, and think of the main gift that we can give to future generations is their capability to do what we will never be asked to do because we won't be around. Our legacy is our lightness, not our heaviness.
And to give our children, our grandchildren, and I guess in old-fashioned language, a rounded education.
Let's call it learning and wisdom,
okay,
which is a little bit different from education.
Although it's hard to give young people wisdom, that comes with time. I think you'd agree with that.
Precisely, yeah. Precisely, which is a very much, you know, it doesn't come on a book and hit you on the head and then you're full of it. It really comes because you've experienced and you've been given a diversity of experiences. And fundamentally, my goodness, you've been given the comfort and the gift of being able to fail.
Yeah.
That didn't work. My goodness. And guess what? Even if you didn't get the answer on the test right, it's not the end of the world. In fact, you shouldn't be tested that way. You should be able to do things over and over and learn the way a child learns through experimentation.
When I was 21, I thought I knew everything. And when I think back now, I must have been an arrogant devil and quite insufferable. But listen, my guest today is Riel Miller, head of Futures Literacy at UNESCO in Paris. And we're talking via Zoom. Riel, I've got to ask you this question because it's an obvious one, but you're probably going to resent me for it. How do you measure what you do? Are you held to some kind of account by United Nations member countries? I mean, you draw a salary from them. I mean, how do they measure your performance?
It's a wonderful question because, of course, I want to know myself whether or not I'm advancing according to my own criteria. I've spent a lot of time thinking about things like measuring what people know. I wrote a book for the OECD back in the 90s on that topic. There are lots of different ways to assess learning. And of course, if we're talking about futures literacy, it's a capability. How do you become a better plumber? How do you become a better reader? Have you read more literature, diverse literature? Are you able to critique it? You know, how do you become a better food critic? Or for that matter, how do you become better at, you know, calling the winning horse in the races? I mean, you have to study it. You have to learn. You have to know that you've acquired knowledge. And I think that there's many ways for us to evaluate futures literacy from that perspective. And we're doing that around the world. Now, one of the things to keep in mind is that futures literacy is a relatively new field. And surprisingly, the even though anticipation is a fundamental characteristic of all living organisms, so it's a fundamental biological characteristic in this universe, very little work has been done studying anticipatory systems and processes. So we're at the beginning, and again, I'll make the comparison to reading and writing. What you do at the beginning, let's say you decide, okay, reading and writing, instead of it being an elite thing, everybody should learn to read and write. Well, you don't know how to do that. You don't know what it means. Schools don't exist. You don't have the buildings. You don't have the textbooks. You don't have the teachers. So there's a lot of things that we're just at the beginning of when it comes to futures literacy. But I'll just give you a couple of indicators that show the kind of success we're having, not because particularly, you know, intelligent or brilliant or whatever, but because in the current moment that we're in, this matters. This resonates. It's human experimentation with the world around us that is driving this forward. And there, I think you're familiar, we had a Futures Literacy Summit in December of 2020, which had over 8,000 people registered. We've now established some 35 new UNESCO chairs in future studies and futures literacy. This means universities around the world.
Universities, yeah.
Yeah, universities around the world are picking this up. And I wanna, I'll end this one on this point. In 1860, there was no American university that had a Department of Economics.
Really?
Okay, in 1860. But by 1890, almost every one of them had a Department of Economics. And that's what we understand because, you know, there was the boom. The manufacturing industrial era was exploding. And so it made sense to do that. Today, there is really almost no university in the world that has a future studies department. I think 10 to 15 years from now, people will understand that that being able to dive deeper and more effectively into the way in which anticipation functions, why and how we anticipate, is crucial not only for understanding the world and making choices, which are not the same thing, by the way, but also for all the other fields, whether you're in political science or physics or whatever. Anticipation matters. And so I see that as again, a signal that this is something that is a metric, if you will, that shows that we're moving ahead.
And so let's talk current issues. Obviously, the pandemic is still very much on people's minds. In rich countries like Switzerland, like France, the vaccine program is moving ahead, but in poor countries, it's still very, very, very slow. What did futures literacy tell you, tell us in advance about COVID-19? And if I could add a sort of corollary to that, will there be a fourth, fifth, or even sixth wave of the pandemic that we're currently in? Specialists, for example, and I'm sure you know this, say that we'll have to learn to live with it, rather like measles and flu. But what can futures literacy add to that debate?
Again, this is central to our times. Right now, we're working with the UN Disaster Risk Reduction in Indonesia on a project about disaster risk reduction. But let me tell you something. This is disaster and shocks like the pandemic. These are changes in the most broad sense. You know, one day you're going to the office and you're not worrying about it. The world changes. The next day, you're working from a completely different place and you're frightened about something you weren't even thinking about 2 days earlier. Okay, this is a change. What is our relationship to change? Is it the arrogant position that, well, it doesn't matter if we create global supply chains, it doesn't matter if we create mass global tourism, it doesn't matter because, after all, anything that could happen, we'll be able to control it. We're such masters of the universe. But in fact, what we do is by having that relationship to the world around us and to the future, this idea that we can control it generates fragility. It generates brittleness. It generates a lack of reactivity because we think, well, after all, we're going to control it. In other words, it's completely the wrong way of seeing the way our universe works. So fundamentally, futures literacy, again, is about a way of redressing what has become quite dangerous for humanity, which is ignoring the nature of the world around us. This is not a deterministic direct linear causal. It's a creative universe. Things that were unimaginable yesterday become reality today because the conditions offered that opportunity. And it's serendipitous. Sometimes it's causal, but it emerges. And so fundamentally what this says is that it's not about living with it as if it was some curse, but rather saying uncertainty is our greatest asset. Uncertainty is something we can use to be creative. And I'll finish on this point. There's no way to know what strategy will actually work. But from experience, and given the nature of kind of combinatorial options, diversification, if you bet on 10 horses, one of them is more likely to win than if you just bet on one. And in order to diversify, you fundamentally need difference. Not only is diversity characterized by difference, obviously, but your ability to create difference depends on difference. Meaning we know that if everything is monotone, everything's the same, everything repeats, well, you have no creativity, you have no inventiveness. But if there's more diversity, more difference, we're able to create even more difference. This means we can take more of a diversification strategy towards resilience. This is fundamentally more viable than the current, I'm going to bet on building a really, 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 really strong castle and make sure that it never, ever, ever, ever falls apart. That's not a great strategy.
Can I just go back to that expression that I read of yours, poverty of the imagination, because it fascinates me, and it basically leads to a number of further debates. How does, and this is the one I want to examine briefly before we finish, how does future literacy inform the debate on university campuses in many parts of the world about what is now called the cancel culture or no platforming? Or put it another way, is futures literacy about to find a way through this sort of very sensitive territory of freedom of expression versus consideration for others and old-fashioned good manners in the context of the robust exchange of ideas which would normally be associated with universities. I ask you this because this expression, poverty of expression, is something which I came across in the things you've written, and it fascinates me, the contribution that you can make to that discussion, that debate.
Yeah, again, I mean, you put your finger on something that I think touches us all and induces confusion and dismay at times. But let me put it to you this way. There's two components I want to touch on very briefly. One is there's the Popperian notion of changes in the conditions of change. In other words, to what extent can we remove ourselves from being in the water and realize that we're in the water? That's being able to understand that there are changes in the conditions of change. That, in other words, what was taken for granted by one generation or by one group is not necessarily taken for granted by another. That's the first thing. So this is the question of being able to use the future to, again, appreciate, not fear difference. The second point is this. The future, and again, this is about futures literacy, is much more than a bunch of quantitative variables. It isn't that quantitative variables are useful for describing the future. It's hotter, it's colder, it's bigger, it's smaller, etc. You can use those variables to describe the future. But the future is also something that we feel, that's emotional, that's emotive, that's empathetic, that's related to being able to negotiate shared meaning and not assuming that you know what the other person feels or what the other person thinks. And using this sensitivity to the richness of our images of the future and the power of the of images of the future to create fear, to create hope, to create despair. You see, violent conflict will always exist. But why does it become violent? Because you've got nothing to lose. You're despairing. And in that despair, you begin to fantasize and you go right up, way past any kind of win-win to a win-lose proposition. And in a world in which we understand how those images of the future, oh, I'm going to be the winner of the war. That's an image of the future. The more that we understand where those images come from, the sources of those images, the more we can originate those images from our own context and our own condition, the more we will care about what seems obvious. I care about the meaning of my life. I care about what I do in my community. I care about how I'm living. And so futures literacy in that fundamental way doesn't call for totalizing, kind of crushing everybody and making everybody equal, but it does call and it empowers, it enables understanding. And by being able to understand better, I think we can have the liberty that you were talking about, and at the same time, the respect that you were talking about, because it requires that kind of humility, but also that kind of attentiveness.
Last question, Real, because you're working at a very high level. You said yourself that this is being introduced more and more into universities. What role, what contribution does futures literacy make to rapid developments in science and technology? For example, artificial intelligence, quantum revolution, gene editing, human augmentation, and the ethics and governance rules around these other dramatic developments. Again, what contribution do you make in that area?
Wonderful question, and you won't be surprised if I say it's profound, because look, this is not a new debate by a long shot. I mean, not only was, you know, the original story about Dr. Frankenstein and his monster about the relationship of humans to invention and tools and technology, but the Manhattan Project and the Doomsday Clock are all indicators of the responsibility of scientists and the danger of our tools. The proposition here, Michael, is not that we're going to be able to control or that our tools control us. It's rather that we are our tools. And I have no better example than the absolutely pathetic use of the internet over the last 20 years. In other words, what we're doing now with the internet is all of a sudden flipping globalization on its head, thank goodness, from an elite pastime for people who could take airplanes and go to conferences and things like that, to being able to now access just about anyone and everyone on the phone and having them be involved. Do we have the etiquette? Do we have the languages? Do we have the rituals? Do we have the signals? Do we have the symbols to make that really function? No. But at last, we see that the tool is circumscribed by the way humans think about the tools, what they want to do with their tools. And in that sense, I do not think that the ethical conundrum of is this tool going to kill us can be resolved ex ante, in advance. You would need to be prescient to be able to answer that question. But what you can do, and this is a difficult point to make for this society, is you can say, taking oil out of the ground, splitting the atom and creating radioactive waste are acts which will have long-term consequences, meaning they will generate monumental legacies. And is that respectful of future generations? Ask if we'd pose that kind of question at the outset of this industrial era. We might not have climate change, and we might not have the kind of lack of respect for the world around us that is tearing us apart today. So it's not a solution in that sense, but it's a way of what is often called reframing the question and looking at it from a different perspective.
Last question. I get the sense, just listening to you, a slight sense of frustration, not anger, but frustration in your tone of voice today. We've had conversations before, and this is not meant to be a naive question and not meant to be intrusive, but would you describe your sense as being optimistic about where we're going? Because you've put all your heart and soul into this, I can tell when I listen to you, the way you speak about it.
Well, you know, I mean,
I'm not trying to flatter you. I'm just being honest with you.
I have a hard time seeing what the choice is. Meaning, I want to have fun, right? I want to learn. And in some senses, you know, it's not always easy to be in a situation where, as life advances, you're experimenting, exploring, testing, pushing, revising. And I've had the good fortune, Michael, for many, many reasons, partly because I'm a highly educated white male from a rich country, to be able to do that. And I'm very cognizant of that privilege. But at the same time, you know, I wouldn't give it up for the world in the sense that I've had a great time and this has been a lot of fun. So I'm very grateful for that. And so this is what's really encouraging, is that I continuously test my ideas, my thoughts with others. And when it resonates, when it generates, you know, virtuous energy, I think, okay, I'm on the right track. And believe it or not, when people say, I don't understand what you're talking about, I think to myself, aha, maybe I'm on the right track. because then we're exploring, then we're experimenting. If I just told people things that they already knew, and I said, oh yeah, that's obvious, then it wouldn't be as much fun.
They wouldn't listen to you, exactly. That's to me, that sounds, to my simple mind, like optimism. You know, it's a quality, it's a blessing, really. Real Miller, thanks so much for spending time with me and answering all my questions. I still have many more questions, Real, but we're out of time. It's been an absolute pleasure listening and talking to you. My guest today has been Real Miller, Head of Futures Literacy at UNESCO in Paris. Thank you so much, Real.
Thanks, Michael. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Great.
That was the McKay Interview with Michael McKay. And don't forget, you can hear that interview again on our website, worldradio.ch.